Hi, everybody. This is Frank Fear with the Sports Column, and thanks for joining me today. The topic is how to reform college sports. And going along with this audio file, there is a PowerPoint presentation saved as a PDF file that you can follow along. I've been concerned about college sports, the state of college sports, for some time, and I have concerns as a huge college sports fan. There are issues surrounding college sports with a special focus on the revenue-generating sports, particularly at the big-time colleges. We can do better. We have to do better. In the pros, the major concern, at least I think on the part of most people, or at least some people, are the individual problems that players tend to get into. At the college level, you don't hear that much about college players, but you hear an awful lot about what's happening at the colleges and universities and the NCAA. We really can do better. The question is, what's the problem and how can we fix it? And that's what we're going to talk about today. I addressed this topic in writing in May with two articles that were published at the Sports Column. And after the publication of those articles, I was invited to make several presentations in mid-Michigan where I live during the summer. And so this presentation actually is an outgrowth of those presentations, and the PowerPoint presentation essentially is the script that I used to make several presentations over the last several months. So let's turn to the, if you could, please, to the PowerPoint presentation, and we'll get into it. You'll notice that on the cover of the, or the first slide of the PowerPoint presentation, there are four visuals. You'll notice that there is a football field with a player who is tackling a tackle dummy with a fellow, a student, we presume, who has a device that he's holding. We'll talk more about that later. Then there's a visual of Northwestern University. You're all familiar with the Wildcats, I'm sure, and we'll talk about why Northwestern is being featured in this presentation. Then you have a strange being called a banana slug. At the bottom right, which is the mascot of the University of California, Santa Cruz. That's important in this presentation for another reason. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. And then you're going to see a chart that's unlabeled, doesn't give you the topic or the issue being addressed, but it's you can see that it starts higher and then trends lower from about 90% to the far left to about 50% or 45%. At the far right over time. So we'll talk about what those mean as we go through the presentation. If we go to the second page, we're going to raise a question here. When you think about what it means to be best in college sports, and if you were to ask that to the public, I think you'd get a pretty uniform response. The prevailing response would be that to be best is about winning. When we think of programs like Duke and basketball, or Alabama in football, just to take two, it's about winning. It's about winning championships, and it's certainly about winning consistently. And all the things that go into it, obviously very important, is hiring and retaining first-rate coaches. You can't win just with coaches. You have to have outstanding athletes. More and more emphasis these days on having modern facilities. And you've got to raise money to support all these programs. And money is raised in a variety of ways. But, you know, when we think about what it means to be best, winning championships, winning consistently, it's just not enough. And so why do we need to expand the concept of best to include things that ordinarily most people wouldn't think about when they identify best programs? One way to think about that question is to think about it in general terms. And then another way is to think about it specifically as it pertains to college sports. When we think about the question or the issue in general terms, we can think about it this way. No matter what field you're in, it doesn't make any difference. If it's medicine, accounting, you name it, McDonald's, serving hamburgers. In all fields, the dominant way of doing things, called the paradigm, changes over time. And it changes because the normal or conventional way of doing things either doesn't work at all or doesn't work as well as it used to. The visual that's there is very interesting. It's a picture, a depiction actually, of a fellow by the name of Ignaz Semmelweis, who was a physician in Europe back in the middle 19th century. Some of you may know, others may not, that for a long while, actually until about the middle of the 19th century, physicians, particularly surgeons, didn't believe they needed to wash their hands. And so as a consequence, when they operated on people, many people got sick, did not recover, and died, not just because of the surgery, but because of the lack of hygiene on the part of the surgeon. And so it changed, and now we don't even think about, certainly physicians and surgeons have to wash their hands. So the paradigm changes, just one example. The paradigm in college sports of winning is the most important thing. It just isn't working. There are all kinds of issues that colleges are facing because the prevailing way in which we evaluate best does not include maybe some of the things it needs to. If it did include those things, we wouldn't be experiencing what happened at Penn State. In fact, it's back in the news again. With respect to what coaches may have known, may not have known, with respect to the circumstances at Penn State going back even to the 70s. We wouldn't be having what's happened at Baylor, which is a very tragic circumstance with sexual assaults. We wouldn't have what we had at what we purport to be happening at Louisville with respect to the recruiting scandal there, or what happened at North Carolina, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, with academic fraud, where an entire department was engaged in academic fraud, and about 1,500 athletes over time were given bogus grades for attending bogus classes. So one of the things that I've been focusing on is if we're going to expand this concept of best, which I think we need to accommodate the circumstances we're faced with, the negatives, what might it be? And what I've come up with is the concept of institutional social responsibility. What do I mean by that? It's really about institutional choice making and the choices that colleges and universities make with respect to sports. And it's about making socially responsible, it's making social responsibility a priority. And it's a priority in relationship to answering fundamental questions. What do we value? What's right? What's just? What's appropriate? And when we give those answers, when we take a position that's socially responsible, the answers that we come up with make it clear what we stand for and what we want to be known for as an institution. Clearly, Baylor doesn't want to be known for what it's experiencing now. University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, one of the best public universities in the country, one of the best universities in the country, doesn't want to be known for academic fraud. So why would we want to include social responsibility in the concept of what a best program is, college sports program? Well, we need to hold college sports programs accountable to the same standards we hold all other organizations. College sports really is about real life. When we think about what takes place in college programs, they're large-scale organizations for the most part, with administrators, chief executives. People are employed. People participate in it. There are fans who affiliate with it. It's a lot more than just the games that are being played. And one of the things that I think is really important is that rather than simply reading articles about the problems that universities and colleges are having in their sports programs, we've got to move beyond elevated social consciousness. We've got to get to actually doing the kind of things, making the kinds of changes that will improve the kind of landscape that we have today in college sports. And I think that starts with an understanding that sports aren't apart from society. They're very much a part of society. And so it's really an obligation. I'm not talking about replacing winning as a priority. It always will be and always should be there. But we have to, I think, admit that what the NCAA, the conferences, and the schools do, particularly the large schools, what they do very well is marketing and revenue generation. They make a lot of money. The big colleges do, the major colleges. The NCAA is a juggernaut when it comes to money making. Branding is done extremely well. Marketing departments at the NCAA and the conferences and the universities do an excellent job. And so now the dividing line, I think, between the professionalized enterprises in sports and the major collegiate enterprises in sports are as narrow as they've ever been, certainly in my lifetime, and I think ever. So the question is, can we just continue on the road we're on without adjustment? I don't think so, because embarrassing issues keep popping up. And what is really frustrating is they keep on popping up, not just at any university, but at some of the otherwise outstanding universities. When you think about UNC, when you think about Syracuse, their basketball program, when you think about Penn State and other institutions, Ohio State, that have had challenges that I think would be addressed by being more socially responsible, these are not minor universities. They're some of America's best universities. And what we have over time really is a pattern that's not an isolated event or two. We have a pattern that needs to be addressed. Now, the good news as we move forward in the PowerPoint is that there is a nascent or emerging movement in social responsibility. And you'll see the first ever conference, major national conference, was held just this year in March, hosted by NYU School of Professional Studies, the Tisch Institute. And it's an excellent start. And you'll see that the conference was Social Responsibility of Sports, where doing good and doing good business meet. And that's extremely important. I'm certainly strongly supportive. And you'll see a quote and a picture of former NBA Commissioner David Stern. Quote, sports has this enormous capacity to really make an important contribution. We should be talking about it as an obligation. And if you watched the ESPYs the other night, you saw a number of outstanding athletes like LeBron James, talking about the current circumstances that we're facing in society today, with Black Lives Matter, with the concern about black men in particular being apprehended by the police, many of them being shot, some passing away. What does all this mean, and what are the obligations of athletes to take social responsibility? And they spoke, LeBron and others, I thought, spoke very, very well. Carmelo Anthony was another one who spoke the other night. This is really important, but I'm going to go beyond individual responsibility, as I mentioned, and talk about institutional choice making and calling that institutional social responsibility. And I'm here to say that this is not something, the challenges that college sports faces today aren't new. For over 100 years, there have been concerns expressed about the safety of sports, particularly football. Since the 1920s, questions have been raised about the commercialization of college sports and what's the dividing line, and is there a dividing line between professional sports and college sports. And at least since the 1970s, there have been concerns raised about the fact that what is the impact of big money on college sports. And what I've done here is pulled out a couple of examples of this historic interest. Some of you may know that there was a major problem facing college sports, football in particular, at the beginning of the 20th century, because players were dying on the field from hits. There were a lot of approaches to the game back then that are very different from what we have now. Some of you may have heard of the flying wedge, which was used on kickoffs, where players would hold hands and then rush toward the ball carrier. And it was a very vicious and very dangerous way in which to take down tacklers. And Teddy Roosevelt basically was getting a lot of pressure. In this graphic that's there on the right-hand side, you'll see there's Teddy, and he's sitting on a device there, and there are several issues that are surrounding him, and one is, you can see in the right-hand side, is a football player. So he was dealing with war, he was dealing with the coal strike, but he was also dealing with the need to reform college sports. So he brought together presidents of major universities of the day and said, you know, guys, we've got to do something here. And so they basically did away with the flying wedge. What came out of that meeting eventually led to the authorization, legalization of the forward pass. And it really improved safety on the field. What's interesting about this quote that I have there, let me read it to you. There is a very definite brain injury due to a single or repeated blows on the head or jaw, which cause multiple concussion hemorrhages. The condition can no longer be ignored by the medical profession or the public. You know, when you think about that quote, you could say, well, gee, that's coming right out of the movie, the film Concussion. But that actually is from the Journal of the American Medical Association from October 1928. So you can see this has been an issue for quite some time. On the next visual, you'll see two of our American presidents, Ronald Reagan, Gerald Ford, both of whom played college football. But at the time that they played it, there was also a concern for the commercialization, the beginning of the concern for the commercialization of college sports. And again, what was the dividing line, if any, between college sports and the pros? So there's a quote here, again, from years ago, decades ago, 1929, the Carnegie Foundation. It is certain that the seriousness with which college athletes are nowadays taken has driven certain well-recognized abuses undercover, but at the same time has propagated and intensified them. As a consequence, the observer is confronted on the one hand with the most lofty ideals in sports, and on the other, by rumors in sports and even well-authenticated statements of questionable practices, deception, and hypocrisy, which constitute the very antithesis of the exalted sentiment. So you think about all the things that participating in college sports can do for the players. You know, helping them, you know, understand the importance of teamwork, focusing on what's best for the team rather than focusing just on what's best for self. But you have all these other things that are going on, the abuses that need reform. And again, that's from 1929. So we go to the next visual, you'll see this is obviously continued. A number of really good books that are out there that I recommend to you. Billion Dollar Ball is an excellent book by Gilbert Gall. It's relatively new on about money in big-time college football. Joe Nocera, who is with the New York Times, who's been writing for a number of years, just wrote a book in this last year entitled Indentured, looking at the rebellion as he sees it against the NCAA. Armin Katayan, many of you know that name, wrote a book called The System. John U. Bacon, who is an outstanding author from Ann Arbor, who focuses a lot of his attention on matters at the University of Michigan, wrote a book also on college football. There are two other books that are at the edges that I'd bring to your attention. On the left-hand side, a book written by Christy Dosh is very well cited, used extensively to accentuate why college football in particular is important for colleges and universities generally. The name of the book, Saturday Millionaires, How Winning Football Builds Winning Colleges. And one of the interesting things, an article I also wrote for the sports column, is I noted how a large number of colleges back in the 40s and 50s in particular dropped college football for financial reasons, mostly Catholic colleges. Not exclusively Catholic, but a large number of Catholic colleges which used to have major college football programs no longer had college programs. They dropped them, Marquette, for example. But I also noted that today there are more college football programs than ever in the history of college football. And the reason is programs, athletic programs like football, can mean a lot for colleges in terms of attracting more students, better students, getting the school in the press, attracting alumni contributions, etc., etc. The other book, which is very interesting, is at the other end of that visual. And it's a book by Walter Byers, Unsportsmanlike Conduct, Exploiting College Athletes. For those of you who know a bit about history, you probably know that Walter Byers was the guy who really set the foundation for the NCAA as we know it today. But as time went on, he became more and more concerned about the evolution of the NCAA, sort of the giant he'd created had become a problem as he saw it. And he went to his grave, I think he lived into his 90s, being very antagonistic about the NCAA. And yet he was the one who came up with the concept of the student athlete, really as a way to avoid state labor laws. If we identify these players as students and athletes, then this issue of having to pay them it would be a lot less likely. One of the things that I think that really informs and helps move us along the road of this institutional social responsibility that I'm promoting is the fact that university researchers are beginning to and have tracked various metrics of things that we should be looking at. For example, if you look at the left-hand side of the visual, University of Pennsylvania, they have a center there for the study of race and equity in education. And that center, among other things, monitors graduation rates among African-American males who are playing revenue-generating sports. And that's where that Northwestern graphic comes from, the cover slide. According to the data that UPenn assembles, the most recent data, Northwestern University had the highest graduation rates among for African-American males playing revenue-generating sports. But if you look at the report, and you'll notice in the article for this week, I have the URL for this particular report. I encourage you, if you have any interest in college sports, to go there and to look through and see where your school, how it ranks in terms of graduation rates. Some of you are going to be shocked by the low graduation rates for African-American males, and the findings of the UPenn study should be looked at in conjunction with the findings of the next one, next report down on the graphic, from the University of Central Florida Institute for Ethics and Diversity in Sports. What they do at University of Central Florida at that institute is to look at the administration of sports, not just college sports, but for the purpose today, college sports, and look at the racial and gender profile of those in charge. And again, you may be surprised, maybe not, when you look at these data and you look at sports, you look at universities and colleges, you'll see that that the predominant profile is that men, white men, are privileged in terms of occupying a variety of role, administrative roles related to college sports, from athletics directors to college coaches, basketball and football, to you name it. And again, the disconnect we're experiencing is the fact, it's pretty obvious, just by watching your television, that the majority of frontline players, both in men's basketball and football, and increasingly so in women's basketball, are African Americans, and yet the majority, vast majority of the head coaches are not. They're Caucasians. And that also connects to the next report, Leadership in NCAA Women's Sports, and that relates to the one of the other graphics on the cover slide. It used to be that about 90% of women's sports, college sports, NCAA sports, the head coach was a woman. Now it's about 50% or less of the sports are coached by women. It doesn't mean that it's better when a woman coaches a woman's team. But one of the things that I think is extremely important is that we certainly don't have conversations nationally. Not sure we're having conversations in the conferences in the NCAA about gender equity. I'm not even sure we're having a conversation about any of these other issues either. The disconnect between who's coaching the players and who the players are. There are other issues here, too, that relate to institutional social responsibility that go beyond who are the players, what's their demographic profile, who are the coaches, and what's their demographic profile. And that leads to the football player that was tackling the device on the cover slide. And it relates to the Ivy League. That picture is from Dartmouth. Dartmouth has been a leader in the Ivy League, and the Ivy League will no longer be having live tackling during practices, either before or during the season, because of the concern about concussions and about repeated blows to the head. So social responsibility includes making adjustments in how we approach the games for the purpose, again, of what's right, what's proper, what ought we do, what do we want to be known for. And one of the things that I find very interesting, based on research that's been done on Dartmouth's approach, is that what they found is the players are learning better techniques by tackling robots that have been designed specifically for football by the engineering faculty and students than by live tackling of other football players. They've actually graded out the players in practices and games and have found that the proficiency as tacklers is enhanced by an approach that actually enhances their health and safety as football players. Now, of all the things I've talked about so far, concussions and concerned about CTE and brain injury and implications of constant jostling of the brain in later life, those are all important. But I think the issue that may get the most attention from the general public is one that we haven't talked about yet, and that's the cost of college sports and who pays for those costs. When we think about athletic revenues, we ordinarily think of what's on the left-hand side of the visual, and that is ticket sales, the revenue that the schools get from the conferences, that they get from NCAA, they get from the media, the revenue that comes from merchandising, the t-shirts we buy, the caps, the seat licenses, which you may know is basically part and parcel of the major college scene these days, both in basketball and football, where you actually have to pay a fee up front for the right to be able to buy a ticket. And sometimes the right to buy the ticket costs more than the ticket itself. And then you have athletic philanthropy, where donors are giving money to expanding facilities or building facilities, has become huge in sports in the last decade in particular. What you may not be as familiar with is what's on the right-hand side of that visual 13, which is the non-athletic revenues, the so-called subsidies to athletics. That includes university general funds, money coming from the money that universities have that get allocated to college sports, and also the fees that students pay. What we're finding is that if we go to the next visual, those numbers are pretty big, and we're going to talk about how big they are. And because they're big, some people are getting concerned. And investigative reporters, as investigative reporters often do and should do, is they see an issue that the public may not know about, and their job is to create public awareness. You see, the topic of the amount of money in college sports and who pays was an issue that was addressed by Bryant Gumbel in Real Sports on HBO. And it also, at least twice, was an issue that was a focus on Outside the Lines with Bob Lee. In my home state, I live in Florida and in Michigan, and in my home state, it has become a major issue in Michigan, and you'll see why in a few minutes. The Detroit Free Press had a feature article on it in May entitled "College Controversy: How Much is Too Much to Pay for Athletics?" And then for the folks at the state capitol in Lansing, one of the trade magazines had an article, "Some Michigan Universities Spend Huge Money Subsidizing Sports." And then in the local paper here, the Lansing State Journal, a feature columnist, Tim Stout, had an article on April 30th entitled "College Sports Burden for Some." And let me read that quote to you. Every region or board of trustee member of a Division I school in America should view the 20-minute segment currently airing on this month's HBO Real Sports program. Again, this is back in April. The middle story is about all the colleges losing money these days in big-time athletics. HBO claims only 22 major athletic departments can meet their annual budgets anymore, and it claims the highest-paid public employees in 41 states are either college football or basketball coaches. I wonder if lawmakers in Lansing notice that when it comes time to allocate funds to the school each year. Well, the reason why investigative reporters are picking up this topic is that there are databases which are maintained and managed and updated by two primary sources, and they're very revealing. One is USA Today Sports, and the other is the Huffington Post in cooperation with the Chronicle of Higher Education. And included in today's article, you'll see it on the website at the sports column, I provide you with URLs for both of these publications, so you can actually spend some time looking at the data, and they're exceptionally revealing. If we were to go, for example, to the USA Today sports site, you would be able to search through a database. This is just for the most previous year, which is the 2014-2015, but you can go back in time. And it provides you with an analysis, the data for revenues, income, and outlays for public universities, the major public universities involved in college sports today. And all of this is searchable. So you can actually do it by conference. For example, you could just push the hypertext where it says conference on top, and you can look at all the schools. For example, I did it just for the WAC, and so now I'm looking at California State Bakersfield, and I'm seeing that they spent $13 million last year on sports, almost $13 million, and they took in $13.3 million, so they actually took in more than they spent. But, and this is a really big but, the reason they were able to do that, in other words, take in more than they spent, is because $9.5 million of the total $13 million that they took in came from these subsidies, either from the university's general fund and or student fees. And if you go to the USA Today site, it actually gives you a percent of subsidies. And at Cal State Bakersfield, 71%, over 71% of their revenues came from things other than ticket sales, conference splits, merchandising, those kinds of things. And then if you go to that USA Today website, you can actually go to the percent subsidy, push that, and you can get a rank order. And New Jersey Tech, the school that upset University of Michigan a couple years ago in basketball, that's how it's gotten its national profile. 91% of its $15 million budget, athletic budget, in 2014 and 15 came from subsidies. And you can go down the list. There are about seven schools, if I recall, in the country, most of the biggies, where there are no subsidies. Purdue is one. Ohio State is another, where basically the program generates resources sufficient to cover all costs. But that's not typical. That's not typical at all. And if you go to the other site, the Huffington Post Chronicle of Higher Education site, it gives you even more data, or it supplements the data from the USA Today site. So what I'm going to do is I'm on it right now. So you can punch in a state or a name. And again, this is public universities only. And it'll bring up schools. So I just punched in Michigan. So I'm able to look, for example, at five schools that came up in this searchable database under Michigan: Central Michigan U, Eastern Michigan U, Michigan State, Michigan and Western Michigan. And what I'm seeing are data that are portrayed or presented for 4 years, 2010 through 2014. And it shows the amount of subsidy for each of these schools. At Central Michigan, it was $94 million over 4 years. At Eastern Michigan, it was $121 million over 4 years. At Michigan State, it was $15 million over 4 years. At University of Michigan Ann Arbor, it was $1 million over 4 years. And at Western Michigan, it was about $100 million over 4 years. And then if you push the hypertext of the university, you'll break down the data and it'll show you how the athletics departments have been financed at those schools. So at Central, over those 4 years, only 4% of the athletic department revenue came from ticket sales. 5% came from NCAA distributions. 69% came from subsidies. And of those subsidies, 100% came from general fund reallocations. Not a penny came from student fees. So it really depends. Now, if we go to Eastern Michigan, for example, If you go to Eastern Michigan, for example, and you look at the same profile, you'll see that student fees constitutes about 7%, roughly about 10% of the tuition paid by students at Eastern go to subsidize the university's athletic programs. If we go back to, I'm going to go back to the searchable database. I'm doing this in real time here. If we went to Western Michigan University, it's like Central, that institutional support is 100% of the subsidy source. Student fees, nothing. But that doesn't mean that all schools are like that. So you can go to schools and you can actually see how much could come from student fees. Let me go back to my PowerPoint presentation here. Let's go to the next one. So let me break down on visual 17. What USA Today, Outside the Lines, Huffington Post, etc., and my analysis have revealed. And it's not a surprising story, but I think it's another reason for the need for reform. And I think why, if there's going to be a reform movement, the driver may be how much money is being spent and, very importantly, who pays for it. A lot of money is being spent each year on Division I public athletic programs, and there are about 230 universities that are major public athletic programs at the college level. But let's not focus on the amount of money that's being generated or spent. Let's focus on the fact that there is a tale of two cities. You probably have heard of this concept of the power conferences. It's real. Represents the major conferences, the Big Ten, the SEC, the ACC, etc. Those are the schools where most of this money is being generated and most of the money is being spent. But for these other schools to make it, they need subsidies. The total amount of subsidies just last year alone in this country among those 230 public universities was $2.6 billion. Subsidies were needed significantly at a lot of those schools. So subsidies were at least 65% of the total athletic budget or income at 120 of the 230 schools, high percentage. And that the need for subsidies was not distributed randomly. It's concentrated in certain states. And the states I've looked at where there are specific concerns, I would say, where if I were a state legislator, I'd be looking at this, are California, Florida, Ohio, Virginia, and Michigan. For example, if you think of Ohio and Michigan, why those two states? Why those two states? Because there are a significant number of Mid-America conference schools who don't necessarily generate a lot of revenue, but play at a big-time level. Why California? Well, you have Cal Berkeley, and you have UCLA, but you have a variety of other public universities who that play Division One, but simply don't have the media market, don't have the fan base that a UCLA and a Cal Berkeley might have. Same thing in Virginia. Same thing in Florida. So for every Virginia Tech, you have a James Madison. For every University of Florida, you have a Florida Atlantic. See what I mean? Tale of two cities. An example is, you can see there, where I say mid-majors and smaller schools at risk. Eastern Michigan has become almost a poster school for the issue I'm talking about. Let me read this for you, and it's from ESPN's Outside the Lines. Over the past 10 years, EMU's football costs were up 65%. Revenues were down 30%. Bob Lee said, gee, if that was a stock, you wouldn't be buying it, you'd be selling it. Athletic department lost $52 million over the last 2 years. EMU drew fewer than 30,000 home fans for all games last year. And EMU has not had a winning football season since Bill Clinton was president. So, in the face of that, we're seeing some socially responsible actions. One is the University of Idaho, that has needed $10 million a year to prop up its money-losing athletic program, particularly in football. It has decided to drop out of Division One to move to the second tier, the football championship tier. They've averaged fewer than three football wins a year since 2000. They make a significant amount of money by playing, I hate to use this term, but what's called body bag games, where they'll go to Gainesville and play the University of Florida for a big paycheck. But the president decided recently enough is enough. And that front slide picture of that creature is a banana slug. And the banana slug is the mascot of the University of California, Santa Cruz. And I really very much like, from a social responsible point of view, what the administration did at Santa Cruz. They basically said, look, we're going to have to increase student fees pretty significantly to support our athletic program. Remember, I said some of the non-athletic revenue sources are either from the college general fund, university general fund, or from student fees. And I gave a number of examples where the primary source was the University General Fund. Well, at Santa Cruz, a primary source is student fees. So the administration actually put it to the students and said, there's going to be a vote, a confidential vote. You vote. Do you want to pay significantly more in student fees? Vote yes or no. And if you vote yes, we keep our program. If you vote no, we're going to eliminate our athletic program. And the referendum passed. The referendum passed. So the students had an opportunity when you ask the question, who pays? At UC Santa Cruz, for the most part, it's the student. The student pays significantly. So what they said was, hey, you decide whether or not this is something where you want your money to be devoted. I think it's a good, these are two examples, I think, of socially responsible actions. Will there be more? I think we know from the experience at the University of Alabama, Birmingham, where the president said, we can't continue to do this. He dropped the program. Alumni came together and reinstated the program after fundraising millions and millions of dollars. That the NCAA needs to provide some kind of cover, political cover, for administrators, boards that come forward and say, look, can we right size, if not downsize, our athletic program so that the budget and costs can be more in line, can align better. The NCAA, I think, from a leadership point of view, would do well to assemble stakeholders and put it to them, how do we do this? And how can we do it in a way where people don't have to give up their careers for doing the right thing? So let's close the presentation today. And again, I thank you for being with us today. If we're thinking about a metric for expanding the concept of best from the perspective of reforming college sports, what might that metric look like? And what I've done in my writing, and you'll see it in the May articles, and you'll also see it on Visual 18 today, what might it look like? And so I identify four areas that I think should be a template or a report card for college sports programs as institutions work better and more diligently in a socially responsible way. Number one is always going to be winning, and I operationalize it by winning percentage and championships won. Why take the field if winning's not a priority? Second is integrity, competing by the rules and playing games fairly, which is really, really critical, obviously. I don't think anybody would disagree with that. The third one is what we've been talking about, social responsibility, addressing social issues surrounding the game as I've tried to describe it here, to be socially responsible. And the last one is community responsiveness, which, quite frankly, is a major thrust at the pro level. It's not possible to talk to anybody who works at the executive level for a pro franchise without that person, if asked, talking about their foundation or what they're doing with their team charity, or how they're giving back to the community and the people in the community. Youth sports programs, providing funding for disadvantaged youth, you name it. A variety of ways in which they're fighting disease, they're making contributions to local hospitals, community responsiveness. What's really interesting and really unfortunate, I think, about college sports is, for the most part, if you make a contribution to the university, it goes to the university for purposes to enhance the university. Why couldn't there be a foundation at major universities that basically focuses on youth sports? Why can't there be more programs for athletes in the communities, for athletes to be more engaged institutionally? I know that coaches are involved a lot, but again, as I said earlier, when we think about the colleges and the pros, in many ways, it's very difficult to separate the two in terms of the salaries coaches are making, in terms of their presence on sports channels like ESPN, Fox, the quality of the players. It's just the division between pro and college clearly is not as wide as it used to be. But as it relates to philanthropy and community responsiveness, there's a long way to go, I think, on the college side, on the university side, before it mirrors gets to align well with what the pros have. So again, I want to thank you for joining me today, talking about at least one way of reforming college sports. And from my point of view, one of the areas that needs an awful lot of work is the area of social responsibility. Would love to hear from you. There are ways in which to communicate with me through the website at the sports column to this article, or you can send me an email at fearfrank, F-E-A-R-F-R-A-N-K, at yahoo.com. That's my email address. And you can also see me on Twitter at Fear on Sports. So thanks, everybody. Have a great day.